This is the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. We are obviously off for holiday, if you weren't aware, but that doesn't mean you don't get anything. Every year when we take a couple weeks off for the holidays, we like to take basically what were the most popular episodes of the year and release them as basically one episode. So we took our three most popular topics, which were 80s movie soundtracks, the multiverse, and let's get controversial, and threw them into one episode. So hopefully if you've missed those episodes, you can catch up on just the topics, and we'll be back very, very soon with our whole awards. And then of course our film and TV extravaganzas in January. So looking forward to that. Looking forward to be back in the podcast circuit, but until then, enjoy. Remember, you can always find more information at thehollywoodoutsider.com, and you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. We have two new episodes that hit this past week, so you can hear some new goodness, and you have immediate access to whatever tier of content you subscribe to when you hit it. That's patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. We're going to start with Let's Get Controversial, move into multiverses, and then we'll hit 80s movie soundtracks, which was by far the most popular topic of the year, which means next year we'll have to hit the 90s. I'm Aaron Peterson. I'm joined by my fellow hosts, Amanda Sink, John Davenport, and Troy Heinrichs. Different people on different topics, but let's start it off. Let's get controversial. Okay, on this episode, we are going to share our very personal controversial takes on movies and TV. Now, what that means is that we think very passionately the opposite of popular opinions in regards to certain things in TV or movies. Some examples would be, and I'm not saying I co-sign on these, I'm just saying that these would be examples of a controversial opinion, or hot take, I guess you would call it. Some people call it these days. I just hate that term. Beverly Hills Cop 3 is the best of the Beverly Hills Cop movies. We all know that's nonsense, but somebody probably believes it. Tom Hanks is actually an awful actor.
Those people are wrong and don't deserve to be here.
But it's possible. It's out there. People out there. The Game of Thrones series ending was magnificent. I might be on that board. I don't know. John Williams scores do nothing for you because you're dead inside. Or even George Clooney was the best Batman. I guess there's something to be said for that. So controversial means it cannot be an obscure thought you have, John. It has.
What?
Yeah. I'm not pointing a finger, but if a finger was to be pointed, I'm just saying it might lend your direction. It has to be against the grain of most popular opinions, and you truly believe it. So don't just be contrarian, Troy, who's not here. It needs to be something you actually believe. Not just saying the opposite because it sounds cool. Everybody understand? Makes sense?
I got the rules.
Got it.
All right. So, Amanda, give us your first controversial opinion. And we're going to discuss if there's a lot of wrongness in your opinion.
The only director more overrated than Paul Thomas Anderson is Wes Anderson.
So by that statement, you're saying that both Paul Thomas Anderson and Wes Anderson are overrated.
I am.
Has to be something to do with the name Anderson.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, who are the directors that I can't stand? And I thought of those two and I was like, hold on, are they related? I need to make sure that this isn't like a familial thing.
Where are you on Paul W.S. Anderson?
Oh my God.
let's not go into all the Andersons.
Okay. Man, I got to tell you, I know a lot of people think Paul Thomas Anderson is like one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. I am not on board with that either. So I find him to be lethargically paced in his films. Like, they're boring.
Both of these directors, to me, create very boring, sometimes artistically beautiful in the way it's presented. Mm-hmm. At most, I would say Wes Anderson has a bit more creativity when it comes to that because he can have some visually appealing pieces. But other than that, I don't give a shit about what they're putting on the screen at all. And yeah, it makes me want to take a little nappy nap.
John, where do you stand on this?
I don't know, because I can say that Wes Anderson has created some very fun, interesting, and engaging movies for me. Other movies that he's done have been movies that I've avoided like the plague just because of the people who love them so much. And then Paul Thomas Anderson, all right, I sort of get it because looking over a lot of the things he's made, I have passed on a lot of them. And the stuff that I have seen, though I think are fantastic movies, I also think that I could have just done better by beating myself with a hammer and knocking myself out.
That's kind of how I feel.
When it comes to Paul Thomas Anderson, I just find him okay. I just find his movies very lethargically paced. Like I said, Wes Anderson, I don't like at all. Not at all. I don't like, it's very much a, it's like quirk for quirk's sake.
Yes.
As soon as you see his name, you're like, oh, it's going to be quirky. Of course it is, because everything he does is quirky. I'm just tired of quirk.
Why did you get gay man accent?
I didn't. It wasn't gay man. It was quirk accent. It was a quirky accent. It was.
So you're saying, are you saying the gay accents are quirky?
Oh, son of a bitch. I'm not going to this corner. No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm just saying that Wes Anderson is a little too quirky for my liking. I don't like that style of humor, I guess, is what it is.
I really want to just point out how we just called the gay accent a gay accent.
You guys did. I did not.
It's an affect, not an accent.
Just letting you know. Either way, it was you guys, sons of bitches. Okay. All right. Happy Pride Month. Jesus.
Yeah, happy Pride Month. Jesus. Speaking of which, John, what's yours?
What's my what?
Your first one.
That's funny.
You missed my joke.
I thought it was clever.
I got it. The movie industry would be so much better off if the nerds didn't take it over.
Oh, that's an interesting take.
What do you mean by that?
It seems like everyone who, you know, I got along with throughout my life who wanted to see movies about you know, cartoon characters that we loved, or see real takes on, you know, comic book characters, all this stuff, see Star Wars dug out from the grave, all these guys who all really wanted to see that, one, and all of a sudden that's all we're getting, and we no longer appreciate the movies that have nothing to do with that.
Oh, so you're saying we went too far to the other side, like we tend to do these days.
Yes.
Whichever side you're on, we go too far to the other side.
Right. So as much as I want to be able to say something like Top Gun is a movie that is an outlier from what I just said, it's not an outlier, because a lot of people who we grew up with, a lot of the nerds, really loved that movie. And to be able to finally see them pull a sequel out of that movie 30 years later is, again, that falls into the category. Now, it would be really bad if we see like another sequel to Iron Eagle pop up. But
would it though? Would it? I like Lou Gossett Jr. I'd be okay with seeing him back.
You're gonna see that cyst on the top of his head pilot a plane?
Stop it. Stop it.
Anyhow, I sort of really miss brand new ideas that were brought to film. Ideas that, you know, would be virtuosity that would have been like, you know, that would never make it today. Mm-hmm. Even if it was brought up to date to current technology, would never make it today.
Well, they've stopped making movies that we used to flock to. A Few Good Men, stuff like that, where like a good courtroom thriller, a good just sexy thriller, like a Fatal Attraction or something like that. Those used to be things that were in theaters and people flocked to them. Now it's just, you're right. I see what you're saying. It's just all comic book movies, sequels to beloved properties we've known from Star Wars, Jurassic World, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
Even the TV shows are more popular if they're geek related.
Yes and no. TV has become the realm of where a lot of those Fatal Attraction type movies have gone to.
But they fall on deaf ears because nobody really, and they don't put the same effort into them.
Right.
You know, it used to be like the biggest stars and, oh, we're matching them up. Halle Berry and Bruce Willis. And, you know, you've got Michael Douglas and Glenn Close. Oh, wow. You know, this is some sexy stuff. And now it's, I don't know, who's Kelly Ripa's husband? That guy and somebody else.
You know, I would almost argue that it's less to do with nerds taking over Hollywood and more to do with just Disney taking over Hollywood.
I mean, there's some truth there, but it's DC too. I mean, I think it's nerds. I think the geek show and Hair at the Earth has been what has doomed us all.
That is where the worst fandoms live.
Pluses and minuses.
Yeah. Yeah. It is really the worst fandom, where the worst fandoms live.
How so? Why do you think that?
Maybe. I mean, think about Spider-Man. No offense.
Hey.
No offense. Think about Spider-Man. Think about all the DC movies. Think about Star Wars. Think about every property that comes from nerds and how, if it's not exactly how that one individual nerd feels it should be, then they're going to argue with every other nerd in the world and say, no, you're wrong. I'm right. No, you're wrong. I'm right. And they should have done it this way. And we're literally going to start an online campaign until Zack Snyder gets his director cut released.
I'm good with that.
Like, just...
You know, I'm good with that.
I know there's been some good benefits that came out of it, but when you think about think about the Star Wars fandom, how evil they can be and mean.
It's like you give the guy who was bullied for his whole life, you give him a little bit of power and they start becoming... You know, you either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
You know, as far as like the Star Wars fandom, like, yeah, some Star Wars fans are the worst human beings on the planet, which is interesting because you would think that a whole story that's, you know, supposed to be anti-fascism and you get these fascists that show up and think,
yeah,
and start like complaining about it. Like, that's... That I guess you're missing the whole point of what's happening here.
Well, hang on. On the same token, I think there's hyperbole on both sides. Like, I'm going to be defensive on that point for a second, because every time you want to be critical of anything that's Marvel or Star Wars or any property like that, it's always you're a hater. So it goes both ways. I mean, people just attack you for having an opinion that isn't...
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially when it comes to Marvel or Star Wars, if you're not on board and you don't love it, then you're obviously a hater. That's not fair. That's not critical thinking. That's you just being a fan.
Or if you liked a DC property, then my God, you just didn't understand it. You don't know film. You don't understand.
Right,
right.
You just don't understand.
There's hyperbole on both sides of it. That's also very true. The thing I'm actually pointing out is like, when like, so I get hypercritical over things like Boba Fett and some of the Star Wars properties, but I tend to think that it's because I know the story better than they do. However, when you're starting to get hypercritical because this character's race shouldn't be in the Star Wars story, or why do we have this, you know, why should we care about this female role at all? You know, when it starts attacking things that are, you wouldn't actually go out in the street and say, hey, this black... Ooh, I almost said it.
Glad you didn't, whatever it was. I have no idea what you were going to say.
Hey, this person, because of race, shouldn't even be involved in the whole story. Like, yeah, that is where you start making the...
I see,
like,
what you're
the cross, you start crossing the line when it becomes a conversation about that. Like the poor girl from... who had...
Kelly Marie Tran.
Yes. All she did was...
Exist.
Show up, nail her audition, and then show up in the story because she did an awesome job in her audition, and all of a sudden everyone just gave her a hard time and like ran her off the internet. Like that's garbage. Like that's treating people like that for no other reason than the fact that their existence is what bothers you. That's where we start crossing a line.
I can agree.
So yeah.
Yeah. Well, man. Now I don't like geeks anymore. Thanks, man. That means I hate myself because I need more self-loathing in my life.
Right.
So here, I'm gonna give you something, and I've always thought this isn't something I just pulled out of my ass.
I'm sure that trunk's got a lot in it.
It's a badonkadonk, man. I'm telling you, it's really. But I want to explain it, and I want you to think about it before you tell me I'm crazy. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And keep in mind, this movie is from the early '80s. It's a different time. It's like 40 years ago, different time. 40 years ago this year, actually this month.
Oh, happy anniversary, mystery movie.
Pride month and 40 year anniversary of this movie. So I think it all connects. So here we go. You ready? I believe E.T. is less a story about friendship than it is an unconventional metaphor or allegory, however you want to say it, for homosexual or interracial love. Let me explain. And if you're,
please do.
And if you're, please don't think anything pervy. The only pervy, it's innocent love. So please relax. It's about loving someone who is unconventional to the rest of your world, your current existence. And if you just think about the film a little bit, it's the early '80s. An outsider arrives that everyone just stares at because they don't understand at this time. They're not used to whatever. The government is hunting them for no reason other than they don't approve. Elliot knows he needs to keep E.T. a secret. His friends all understand because they love Elliot and they have no problem with it. But the older adults, oh, they have issues. Elliot and E.T. immediately have an unbreakable bond. When separated, they even feel each other, like deeply, like feel each other.
You're right.
E.T. watches the sweeping romantic movie, and that takes over Elliot's body, which prompts him to kiss a girl while E.T.'s thinking about maybe kissing Elliot, and it takes over. There's a way. I'm just saying. Elliot's mom doesn't approve, but comes to love E.T. and wants to keep them together. When the government pulls them apart, both Elliot and E.T. start to break down because their love is so strong. E.T. knows he has to go back to his family because in this era, no one understands E.T. and Elliot's love. So Elliot's friends help him get back to his family, where he tells Elliot he'll always be right here in his heart with this gigantic glowing heart to prove it. So tell me, how is this not a love story?
I think when you...
Well, I'm sold.
Yeah, when you put it that way.
I've had this conversation with people over the years, and of course, they always say I'm crazy before I even speak.
I've honestly never heard this take before, so I don't know if it counts as controversial, because I've never heard anybody else ever talk about it.
Please go state it in a public forum.
I was going to say, but I think now that it's out in the ethers, people are going to come for you and be like, no, but I agree with you. I think that's an interesting observation.
I actually firmly believe it's probably more homosexual, I would say, than interracial. But I was just trying to think, like, at the time, those were kind of still taboo. Interracial was still taboo. And I know that because I lived, you know, even though times had changed, they hadn't changed that much. And homosexuality was really looked down upon. So with the government constantly basically implying horrible things about homosexuals and stuff like that. So I've always thought that this was kind of like a very small, innocent way to show love between two boys, that it happens, you know, and it doesn't, you don't have to think, like, I've had this conversation and people automatically go dirty, and that just irritates me, because I'm like, you didn't think it was dirty when they were just friends, so, you know, why do you have to make it that way? It's, you can love all children, like, at that age, at Elliot's age, love somebody, they have a crush on somebody, so, I mean, that's, I think it was completely normal. And I think if you think of it in that way and you watch it in that way, it becomes a different kind of movie and it kind of a beautiful story.
I like that. We need to have Steven Spielberg's take on this, his response.
I'm sure he's going to take my calls. I'll put the call out. All right. So now we are back to Amanda.
Okay. This is something that I've talked about on the podcast before, but only in specific episodes.
Is this about Tom Cruise being a stuntman?
No, you know what? I purposefully did not put this my Tom Cruise opinion on this list.
Okay.
Because it's not that controversial. There are plenty of people that agree with me.
All right.
Anyway, my number two, The Notebook, is probably the worst depiction of a romance to admire than any other film. Noah manipulates this woman who is seeing someone else to go out with him, or else he will kill himself. And every time she gets a little bit of happiness, he's there to try and swoon her away, regardless of the implications. Their relationship is incredibly toxic and unhealthy. Nothing about this should scream romance and love. Now, in the end, is the ending very sweet because of the health condition? And it's all very sad and sweet. But their entire relationship leading up to that moment is nothing to admire.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would edit it. Though I agree with that, I'm not going to say the entire relationship, but I'm going to say the entire courtship up until the marriage, because we don't know what happens after they get married beyond like this incredible bond that they have at the end of the marriage.
That's fair. But even when she's engaged to someone else and he's like relentless, like this man does not let her just say no and just live with it. He's like, oh, well, I got you to say yes one time before because I threatened to drop myself off a Ferris wheel. So I'll get you to say yes again.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me because I don't like that movie. I just don't enjoy it at all. And the end is like, wait, dementia the whole time? That's where we were at? How did I not see that coming?
It was a good twist.
It was a great twist. Sad, very sad. Yeah, I can see your point. I didn't like their romance, and maybe that's why. I just thought the whole thing was very tragic, but not in a good movie way. Just more of a, well, that's sad. God, I'm glad it's over too. Also not meant for me. I'm on board, Amanda, mostly because I don't like that movie. So you got me sold. Apparently John's not sold yet, but
Oh, no, I'm sold, but I don't feel like I'm qualified to respond.
Okay. All right, so what's your next one, John?
You know what? I just realized that my next one maybe blends in with my first one, but let's try it. Star Wars, it should have ended with Return of the Jedi, and we've never should have never seen anything after that.
So you think all of the stuff that we've gotten since is not worth it?
Well,
does that include your extended universe books? Does that include the books, or is that we're just talking films here?
We're just talking films.
Okay.
Because my books are awesome. So shut up about that. But we don't talk books in here.
Yeah. Well, then allow. So, Kathleen Kennedy said we can't talk about them.
Right. Screw her. But don't worry. I'm sure somebody's going to remind us that Kathleen Kennedy has no like writing power or something like that. You know who you are.
Yeah, apparently you do too. Call him out by name, John. Call him out.
No. It's okay. Continue your point.
So my point is that, you know, since Return of the Jedi, you know, we got the prequels and, you know, a lot of people who are of a certain age love the prequels. A lot of people of a other age, not so much. And then we got the new movies. And again, this is, again, one of those situations where a lot of people of a certain age love those. And I'm talking like toddlers. And then everybody who remembers the first six movies, not so much. And then we have these shows that where the best character and the best show that we have is of a character that's not from the history of the movies at all. It's a brand new character, gives us a brand new enjoyment for it. Everything where they try to bring up Boba Fett, I could have told him. I think I did tell him. I think I told everyone that that would have been a bad idea to bring Boba Fett back. Now we have Obi-Wan, and that's Obi Snooze, because it's not that interesting of a show. And it doesn't give me anything new to be excited about because, again, I feel like I know where the story is going. So, yeah, if we would have just been able to end at Return of the Jedi, I could have maintained my love for Star Wars as opposed to feeling like I spent a good majority of my life loving something that will never love me back.
Well, that ending just got really sad and tragic, just like The Notebook. But I would, you know, I can see both sides. I can see why someone who had a beloved affection for Star Wars would want it to end and not see any of the lesser than aspects. But at the same time, that's how a property, it's one of the ways that they've gotten to have Star Wars live on with multiple generations. And you said it yourself, the next generation, a set of films are made for, and they connect to, you know, my generation. A lot of us like the prequels because we grew up with it. You know, that's what came out when we were kids. We know they're not great movies, but we still have an affection for them because of that. And then this next set, of course, when there's another generation. So it's basically just making a new set of movies for that following generation and trying to continue that and make it live on. But I understand why someone who was so connected and saw the originals would be like, no, we didn't need more. And I don't care about these other generations loving Star Wars. They could have just loved the originals if we, you know, we could have just made that persist. So I see both sides to this argument.
There's a trick here because they started episode 4, 5, and 6. Like those are 4, 5, and 6. So I think it's perfectly fine to have episodes 1, 2, and 3. And then also 7, 8, 9. I'm fine with that. What I think should have happened, in my opinion, is Skywalker should have been done with 4, 5, and 6. You've got a whole world out there, and they have to connect every damn saga series to the Skywalkers. It's all Skywalker. And now even the series are all connected to Skywalker. Everything's a freaking Skywalker movie. You know, even Rogue One had nothing to do with Skywalkers. They got to have a Skywalker pop in. You know, they got to have Leia show up at one point and be like, hey, what's up? This magical glow. What's going on? Like, there's no reason that they have to, even in the show, you got Mandalorian, you got Boba Fett, shows where the characters should never show up, just frequently just show up because they're like addicted to the Skywalker name. And I think it's ruined it and diluted the property so much that it has kind of ruined the concept of what Star Wars was at one time, which was this vast imaginative universe of endless possibilities. And instead, and just a vehicle to meet up with a Skywalker again. And then, and it's such cheap nostalgia because they do it. And every time fans get just lose their shit over it and they get super excited. And all I keep thinking is that's all it takes, man. Like, it doesn't matter if the story sucks. Like, Boba Fett was a crappy series, but you show Mando and you show Skywalker and people lose their minds. And I'm like, this is why
don't
you
forget
keep
Grogu.
What's that?
Don't forget Grogu. Yeah, Grogu shows up in it too.
Yeah, don't forget Baby Yoda. And I'm just going to keep calling him Baby Yoda. I don't care what his name is. It's just, I agree with you to a certain extent. I think it's been mismanaged. I don't think it was wrong to do it, but it's been mismanaged completely. And everything is banked on nostalgia instead of creating something unique. And they get a pass a lot for some reason. And I don't understand why. So that's an interesting point, John. It does connect to the Thanks. Earlier one, but hey, still works.
Don't worry, my third one also connects in a weird way.
You did plan for this episode, right? Like, it wasn't just like just now? You showed up and be like, ah, oh, shit, I got three things, and they're all Star Wars.
I got a three-day weekend, and it's because of Juneteenth, and I've been drinking a lot, so no.
All right. Stanley Kubrick, this is my second one. Stanley Kubrick is a great visual artist. I think he is very imaginative in terms of his visual representation on film, but I think he's a mediocre film director. 2001 is a boring mess. Dr. Strangelove, I'll give you most of that because it's unique and interesting, but even Rob Zombie had one good one. Spartacus was okay, but that was all Kirk Douglas. What? What's so funny?
The Rob Zombie.
Oh,
just the Rob Zombie.
It's true though, right?
It is true.
Nothing in the direction of Spartacus really impressed me that much. The rest were a real whiff to me. Eyes Wide Shut had a great orgy scene, but that was a crappy movie. Full Metal Jacket, half the movie's great because of D'Onofrio, and then the second half is absolute garbage. The Shining didn't even resemble the source material in any way, shape, or form, and people excuse hamming it up as great acting. Ridiculously over-the-top performances across the board. I don't find Stanley Kubrick to be a good director. That's my second one.
I don't agree with you. I don't think he is as...
Well, that's probably why it's controversial.
It is, yeah. I think a lot of his movies are very mediocre, but even if you didn't...
Doesn't that kind of prove my point?
Hold on. Let me finish speaking. Stop interrupting women.
Don't cheap shot me.
Dr. Strangelove was fantastic.
Blah, 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 blah.
Full Metal Jacket was fantastic. You also left out A Clockwork Orange, which was wild.
Oh, I guess I did leave that out. You're right.
Yeah. And even if The Shining doesn't resemble the source material, it's still good if you think of it independently.
I don't agree with that.
I know you don't. Mm-mm. But I agree with you on 2001. I agree with you on Spartacus. I think he's had a few, you know, really good movies where he was able to shine his light and do well. But I think if you look at his entire compilation, his entire portfolio of film, he becomes much more mediocre. So I agree with part of your sentiment and not all of it.
I agree with the majority of it. Clockwork Orange, people sat me in that stupid chair and pried my eyes open and did the eye drops in my eyes to make sure I sat down and watched that movie. It was not a lot of fun, and it was not as interesting as people made it out to be.
Agreed.
Especially in the 90s.
So much so that I forgot it, John.
Yeah? Yeah, that's true. Yeah. 2001, hi, Dave. That's not really good for me.
Lolita?
No. Mm-mm.
I like Lolita.
It's a hard pass. Like, there's a lot of things that he's done that I can't even say that I've enjoyed. Now, the visuals and the way he frames a shot and the way, you know, and the intensity that he puts into some things is pretty great. But the rest of it, his pacing is always off base. His engagement, it's off base. The way he directs his actors, way off base. So there's a lot missing from his movies, I feel.
There we go. You really like Lolita?
I do.
I feel like you and Roman Polanski are the only ones that like that movie.
Stop.
Wow.
Zynga. By the way, he should be banned. All right. So,
yes.
Amanda, back to you. Number three. What do you got?
That's another controversial take.
That's not a controversial take. He's a piece of shit, and I hope he rots wherever he is.
Well, no, I agree, but the Academy doesn't seem to necessarily agree.
I think the Academy should be absolutely ashamed of themselves forever allowing anything he directed after that point to come into the Academy. They should be ashamed.
They should be ashamed.
They really should be.
My third is that shows like Parks and Rec and Brooklyn Nine-Nine have made The Office unwatchable and annoying for me. Michael Scott was actually the worst part of that show. I'm going to add to it. So it's two controversial takes all part of one.
Okay.
He has never been an interesting or funny character.
What?
Yep. The only reason that this show was watchable.
Are you saying Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Parks and Rec are better than The Office?
100%.
Yeah. Now, I've never really given The Office a shot. I've sat down. It feels way too much like work to me.
That's what she said.
No, she really did. And then these three shows have all the same DNA. Parks and Rec actually was following the same makeup as The Office for the first season and broke away in the second season. Because Parks and Rec, the first season, was not nearly as enjoyable.
100%.
Right. Not nearly as enjoyable as the following seasons were. And Brooklyn Nine-Nine didn't make the same mistake and just went all in at the first jump. So, like, I 100% agree with what you're saying as far as, like, The Office being one of these unwatchable and annoying shows because, yeah, it feels too much like work. And I didn't, like, the episode I watched, I'm like, wow, I'm Jim. I'm sitting there surrounded by people who are doing the craziest stuff. And I'm like, I see it all and no one listens to me. So, yeah, there we go.
Well, that's why it works, though. I mean, I'll be honest. I don't like comedies across the board. I mean, very, very rarely. I mean, only Murders in the Building is obviously an exception. Cobra Kai is an exception. But The Office is one I don't know them by heart. I don't watch it religiously. But if it's on in background, I will laugh, like, typically. Unlike Friends, where if that's on, I just don't find anything in there funny. Brooklyn Nine-Nine, occasionally, but it's usually Terry Crews. Andy Samberg, I don't find funny. Parks and Rec, I've tried multiple times, but I've only watched the first season. But I
Where it's not good. That's what John has a perfect observation.
I am not watching more.
No. Just jump into the second season.
No, you misunderstand. I watched 10 episodes. I will not watch anymore. I don't care. I just don't care. I gave it as much as I could give it. I'm done. So nothing there worked. Where I've seen multiple episodes of The Office from various seasons, and I typically laugh. And I do think Steve Carell is over the top. And I do think the British Office is superior in many ways, but it's also very, very short and compact. But Jim is amazing. Pam is amazing. And it makes me laugh. Usually, I'm always guaranteed at least a stupid chuckle with that show. So I guess I get that's why it's controversial, except for you and John. You guys are on board.
Yeah. Troy would probably disown me and kick me off, get me kicked off this show if he heard this right now.
What kind of power do you think Troy
has?
No,
he could just let you do what you're going to do and you'll do it to yourself.
Oh, ouch.
He doesn't need to kick you off. He just won't show up for a couple weeks. And then he takes over. That's how it works.
Look at the face. All quiet. I have been called out and it hurts.
John, you're a third.
My third. The Snyder Cut is a much better movie than the Avengers Age of Ultron.
Agreed.
I don't think that's really that controversial. I feel like that's true. That's just fact.
Oh, all right.
But go ahead. Well, then, why do you feel that way?
Well, I don't need to. I mean, if everyone's going to agree with me, let's just go on to my fourth and final one then. Jordan Peele is not though a great writer-director, he is not the greatest director of our current generation.
Oh, my God. John, if you get murdered, it's not me. I just want you to know it wasn't me.
I don't even understand your
take. I have an alibi.
His take is very specific to Amanda.
And it's not even how Amanda feels.
Not anymore, because she's like, I shouldn't say shit like that.
He's the pioneering director of our time.
Oh, my God.
People can't just be good anymore. They got to be the pioneering director of our time.
Oh, my God.
But he is a great
I'm
director.
So proud of myself.
He is a great
You're so sassy.
I wonder if there's people, going back to your earlier point, do you think there's people that still haven't watched the Snyder Cut because of their absolute disdain for
Yes.
for Snyder.
And, yes, absolutely.
I know people.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. I was married to people.
So it isn't even... It isn't even because of, you know, Justice League burned them so bad. It was because they just don't like Zack Snyder. Is that...
They just don't like his movies or the DC movies. They, yeah. If they didn't like... Yeah, 100%.
I don't...
I think a lot of people see it as, I already gave a bunch of my time to watch the original version.
Fair. I mean, that's fair.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not going to... given more time to potentially still not like it.
I think that's a fair assessment. I just mean, like, if you don't want to watch it just because you hate Zack Snyder, I'm like, well, that's an extreme. But you know what? Gotcha. I won't watch a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah. No, I get what you're saying.
Right.
I'm officially done with his stuff. So I guess I can understand that.
Hell yeah, you are.
So the person I sat down and watched that movie with when it came out on HBO, who is a person who's very exhausted by superhero movies and you know, and the like, sat there and enjoyed, even though it was a 4-hour movie, she was also very exhausted by movies that were longer than 45 minutes, I think.
So any movie? So movies in general?
Anything that's not a short. Okay.
Right. Anything that's not a short. That person actually found, like, as we were watching it, she was like, okay, so is this scene in that other movie? I'm like, yeah. Okay. She goes, all right. So that the only redeeming qualities of that other movie, are they all pretty much just Zack Snyder shooting? I'm like, probably. So.
Yep.
I think that's a fantastic film. It really is. I mean, it's 4 hours. It's really long as hell, but I think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I ain't ashamed of it. My last controversial opinion. Mm-hmm. I believe, and I believe this wholeheartedly, that The Goonies is a more impactful, earnest, enjoyable film about friends and friendship on an adventure and a quest than Lord of the Rings.
Well, yeah, because that entire second movie is just them walking.
They walk so much faster in Goonies. But if you think about it, it's the same idea. A bunch of friends go on a quest at their own peril. They all have their quirks. They all contribute. Mikey's big brother is just missing a sword, and then he'd be Aragorn. The Fratellis look like orcs.
That was bogus.
they need to save their home, the Shire. They have real moments of heartache, friendship, kinship, all while avoiding death and danger. They also learn empathy for a broken-down villain who's a tragic character in Sloth. They also realize which treasure they need to let go because it's not meant for them. And this is the same story. It's just told in 7 hours, less time, with better friendship, humor, and all-around joy. The Goonies is the better version of Lord of the Rings.
Hey, you guys.
Natalie Dormer said hi.
You're a monster. Anyways, I would agree with that on multiple levels. I think when that movie... hit when I originally watched it, it was something that taught me how friends should be as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I can't see myself watching Lord of the Rings and being like, oh, this is how friends should be. One person should be this completely dysfunctional, completely unhealthy for you person, and you got to carry them up a freaking mountain. That's a bad idea.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes more of a study on helping someone with addiction than
I was just going to say that movie has always felt to me like an example of helping someone with addiction or being that support system of someone who has an addiction, because it was so toxic and unhealthy that I wouldn't necessarily, I would say that Samwise is a great depiction of friendship because he was there to support. Yeah. He was there to support in every aspect and never let his friend fall over the cliff. If you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, everybody else is like, go on. They'll be fine.
But I would not say that it is a reciprocal friendship for a lot of the movies. And the second one is very boring.
Not at all.
So I would. And Goonies is so much fun. And they accomplish the same amount in just a much shorter time period.
And I feel like they're better friends.
Yeah.
They are better friends in Goonies because in Goonies teaches you that you can have disagreements with your friends and they're not friendship ending.
Exactly.
That's a good point. Yeah.
You can have disagreements with the people that you spend time with, and there's still a lot of love and respect there. You know, that's something that I think that people these days have a little bit of trouble with anymore, because like friends have become very disposable and interchangeable versus people that you create your own family. And That's something that I always loved about most of my friendships throughout the years, is that they were my extended family, and I loved them all for that. And I get that from movies like Goonies, movies like The Flight of the Navigator, Explorers. Yeah. Actually, Flight of the Navigator is another good one. You know, movies like those were movies, you know, Optimus Prime, you know, he taught me all these things combined combined into one thing that create the amount of like, no quit that I have for my friends. I will let them quit me any day of the week, especially when I start realizing how toxic they are for me. But if it's just something where it's a simple disagreement or simple not seeing eye to eye, those are all things that should not be friendship ending or, you know, life changing or any of that.
All right. Well, now we've got some listener thoughts, like their controversial takes on certain things. You guys ready to hear some of those and we can discuss?
Yes. I'm ready to hear some of those. Okay.
So David Phillips Jr. says The Wiz is way better than The Wizard of Oz.
Ah, great take.
Way better songs and more interesting dance numbers. Just all around more interesting representation of that story.
I'm not biased because I was in The Wiz as a play, but
do you like the songs better? Than
I do. I think it's more fun.
Explain. Why is it just all around?
Exactly. Everything that he said is the perfect explanation.
I don't know. I feel like I'm partial to it because it's one of my mom's favorite movies. So I watched it 1,000 times and it brought her joy. So it brought me joy by watching her have joy. Mm-hmm. But The Wiz is great, too. So
you're wrong and I'm right.
OK, there we go. We'll go with that. John, do you have any feeling on this either way?
I don't know if I've ever seen The Wiz.
You really should watch it. You really should.
I probably should.
You should.
So, but I, at the same time, I don't, like, The Wizard of Oz is a movie that I can't watch anymore.
Is there a reason?
It just bores me.
Okay. Well, there's no place like home, I guess. Andreas, he says, the only movie that came to my mind for this topic is Irreversible. The scene in the underpass was so appalling that I won't watch this movie ever again. One could argue that it's needed to be as realistic as possible, but I think it was too much, at least for me. And the movie he's talking about, if you don't know what Irreversible is, it's a movie with Monica Bellucci where she is raped under an underpass. And the story is, it's a very, very, I mean, damn near pornographic. It's a real-time rape scene that's horrific to watch. And by many critics' accounts anyway, that scene is a very intense and it kind of brings to life just how horrible rape is.
I think I don't need you to show me how bad rape is for me to realize how bad rape is.
It's one of those where I find the movie is very moving, but that scene is impossible to rewatch, I think. So I kind of see what he's saying. That's an interesting take because a lot of people love that movie because that scene's in there. Hmm. And I think a great director wouldn't need to show all of that, which means Kubrick definitely would. I said it.
That was funny.
Mac Herring, Furiosa did not steal the show in Fury Road. The character does not need a standalone movie. Make another Mad Max with Max instead. Discuss.
That's Charlize Theron's character, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Sorry, but no, I don't give a shit about anything but Charlize Theron. She did make the movie for me. I understand why people who have more connection to like the original and stuff might enjoy more than Charlize Theron. But for me, this was not my type of movie. And I also didn't really enjoy it that much aside from her. And because they just go in a circle and that's always bothered me. Like, I feel like this is dumb. You just wasted my time. But I think that Charlize Theron, whatever she's in, steals the show 100%.
Yeah, I'm going to have to say that Charlize kind of stole the show on that one. I watched that movie once and I would have to say that Tom Hardy, though usually a great and engaging actor, didn't do much in that movie. Like, he didn't really show up too much. Now, that could also be said about the Mel Gibson Mad Maxes because of the way he's playing that character, which is very toned down and very quiet.
Very stoic.
Very stoic, yeah. And so there is that through line when it comes to the two different characters of Mad Max, how they've been portrayed as they're basically the thing that's carrying you through the story, but the story is actually the things that are happening around him.
Yeah, I mean, I get why this is a controversial take, because I don't think you're going to find many people that agree with you on that one. I found Tom Hardy to be okay in that movie, which is, I think he's a great actor, but he's just okay in that movie. And I love that movie, and I love it a lot because of Charlize Theron. Now, I agree, it doesn't need a standalone movie because Charlize Theron isn't in it. And that makes the difference for me. It really does. But, man, I would still watch another Mad Max movie, though. I mean, George Miller is a great director, so I'm sure it would be fun. But Brandon Smith. Ooh, this is a hot take. I don't like Scott Pilgrim. I found nearly every character to be unlikable and poorly written, and the world made no sense. And Brandon, I am with you 100%.
No!
100%.
I like Scott Pilgrim.
I like Knives Chow. That's it. So much. As soon as the movie was over, I had to look her up and make sure she was legal, because I felt bad.
Ew.
She's super cute. But yeah, I don't like that movie. So you guys, most people think this is a great movie and Edgar Wright can do no wrong. Are you on that same plane? Are you with Brandon or against Brandon?
I'm against him. Sorry, Brandon.
I'm against Brandon because I find the movie visually appealing. I find it to be fun, and like the jokes within it are something that I enjoy. I don't like Michael Cera, and I don't like a lot of the other actors in it. But for whatever reason, whenever it's on, I can sit down and watch it.
All right. Billy Axel Foley says Ghostbusters is boring. What? No. Yeah.
What?
Enjoy your hot take.
Yeah. You're on your own, pal.
Can't help you with that one. That's nonsense. Stefan Smidebeck says hype around movies is a turnoff. I rather wait to check stuff out unless I already decided a long time ago that I want to watch some movie. So he's saying that hype around movies is a turnoff. Is his controversial opinion? He doesn't like hype.
I feel that I am going to have to more or less agree with him. I start distrusting things that get too much hype. I start sitting there going, yeah, but what's wrong with it? Why? Like, how could it be that awesome? I've been fooled before way too many times when it comes to hype, whether it's hype from my group of friends, whether it's hype from, the ads and, news articles or whatever. Like, I start getting really distrusting of it. I've been my biggest and easiest one to point to is like my group of friends really loved Avatar, the first movie. Mm-hmm. And they were like, you have to go see Avatar. It's one of the best movies we've ever seen. It's amazing. It's great. And I fell asleep in that movie. It's not as fun and exciting as the people made it out to be.
I think that hype can... It's not going to make or break it for me. If I'm interested in watching something, I'm going to watch it. If I'm not interested in watching something, I'm not going to watch it. I have trusted sources that I go to, but I don't know. I just feel like there are some people who are a little bit more contrarian when it comes to hype. If they hear hype, they're like no, then I don't want to watch this because it's too hyped up now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's what he's saying or if he's just saying like that it doesn't matter to him, like that's not going to affect him.
I just tune it out.
Yeah,
like, I try to tune it out because honestly, there's certain properties that I know there's going to be hype before it ever comes out. So I will wait and just check it out myself. And I just stay objective, especially Star Wars or Marvel. You can always guarantee there's going to be ridiculous hype and it's the best thing ever. And it's just like, no, it's not. So every next iteration is the best thing ever. Come on. Just you're ridiculous. Because there's always people in our circles that are like that with certain properties.
Yeah.
It is what it is. Last one. Lauren Thomas Williams says Sister Act is better than Sister Act 2. Are there a lot of people that think Sister Act 2 is better than Sister Act?
I didn't know there was a Sister Act 2.
Wow.
I actually think there's a Sister Act 3, but
no,
I might be wrong about
no,
that.
There's no Sister Act 3. I agree. The first one's really, I liked the first one a lot. The second one I didn't like at all. So Amanda didn't even know there was one.
I didn't even know there was a second one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where she.
I know I saw them both, but I've forgotten them entirely.
Is this a very controversial opinion?
I don't know.
Lauren.
I don't know. Says it is, you know? Journey Through the Multiverse. Because there's a lot of them coming out. This is going to be a conversation about the multitude of movies and TV shows that now have established multiverses as a core concept. Marvel, DC, they have them. Spider-Man's doing it. Doctor Strange has it coming out. DC's got their Flash movie coming out, which is going to be their version of a multiverse. But it's also expanding into unique and new properties like Everything Everywhere All at Once is huge on the multiverse concept. Joel Edgerton's upcoming Apple series Dark Matter, same kind of concept. So what do you think about this concept as a whole of utilizing the multiverse?
All of my favorite shows are multiverse shows. So I absolutely love this. Start with Fringe, for example. Fringe, probably one of the best uses of multiverse to actually explain how things are actually changing between each season and the characters and how they grow and how they actually have to work together to save each other's sides of the equation. I think it's probably one of the best uses of multiverse that I can think of.
What do they do specifically that makes you go, that's why this is one of the best uses of this?
I could say, but it kind of gives away the surprise of the show.
I'll dance around a little bit. Give us an idea.
Basically, there's a mad scientist who is experimenting on both sides of the universe. His version is experimenting on both sides. And based on the experiment, one of the children dies. And as such, the child of the other universe basically becomes the focal point of the war between the two doctors. And that is the crux of the show. And based on that one decision, it escalates the war between the two universes and they fight against each other, where really they should have been thinking about something that's really more important. And that's the future actually coming back to fight them because of this war, it's actually ruined the future. And so instead of working together, they've been working against each other this whole time. So they have to learn how to work together to fight what's coming from the future.
Okay. I kind of wanted your assessment of why that one does it so well.
That's only because Aaron still hasn't finished watching the show.
I sure haven't.
Well, the other side of it is that you get to see the two sides of every coin. In each coin being a character of the show, you get to see the what if nature of what that character would be if such and such thing happened, and that's why it does it so well and so seamlessly. It's just like the whole concept of multiverses work out because, you know, in one season you got a character, or one place you got a character that's a villain, but yet you still kind of like that villain, but then you get to see him someplace else in a multiverse version of himself, and now you're kind of allowed to like him because he's not a villain anymore, but he's still more or less the same character. So there's a lot of aspects that you get to play with and reuse characters in different aspects that really get it's just a lot of fun.
I think there's another way you could look at multiverses too, and it's a sense that it's a character yet you never see. But because you never see it, it drives the motivations of the characters within their own context. A great example of this would be The Leftovers. So you have the people that were the ones that are quote unquote still here and weren't the ones that crossed over to the other side. And all they do for the entire show is think about, well, what if it would have been me? What if I could have gone over there? Would my life have been better? Some even try to build a machine so that they could actually try to traverse and go over to the other side. And because of that, and you never see what the other side is, but because it's always present, it becomes a character in itself for the show. And it just drives the entire narrative because it's always a possibility to go there.
What do you think is most appealing about it? Is it the ability to see different sides of the coin, like you guys kind of talked about, or is it the ability for writers to kind of retcon their own choices? I mean, in a way, they can do that, but it's also, you know, you can create layered performances from actors because they can play things different ways because of multiple worlds, etc.
Well, there's the surprise aspects of it. There's a certain movie that has a certain award named after it that we have that plays with the concept of multiverses. And I don't want to, that's the one. Okay. I didn't want to really say which one it is because
you just want people to go dig through like hours and hours of podcasts to try to get.
I'm trying to get our numbers up, man.
Jesus. It's Coherence. Go look it up.
Yes, it's Coherence. Go pick it up. It's a good movie. Anyhow, here you have a movie that plays with that whole aspect of multiverses, and at no point throughout the movie do you know once it finally lands at what you're dealing with, you don't know who belongs where, what's going on, how, and which direction everything is going, and it's the surprise nature of it all.
I think, like you said, it also gives the writers the ability to expand on stories and just kind of think like, what if, right? Two that come to mind would be Man in the High Castle. Like, what if the Germans and Japanese ended up winning World War II? What would have happened had that occurred, and what would have happened in the United States? I think it's a fantastic idea. And then the way that they actually traverse between the Nazi-controlled, you know, Axis Reich of the current day into the other side, so that they can understand what actually is happening, to bring back that information. And then, of course, that drives the whole port of the Nazi machine towards the end of season four. I think that's just fascinating when you think about some of the things that could have happened, you know, had one butterfly effect gone a different way. Sliders is another great example, where the whole point of the show was, oh crap, we slid to another parallel world and we can't get home. And so every time they encounter another world, it's, well, what if penicillin wasn't made? Or what if, you know, the women were in charge and men were slaves, or a couple of the other ones. And then it became this whole thing where the Cro-Mags, where they never were truly fully developed humans, they ended up invading because of the time or the world jumping that they take place on. And then all of the worlds were now basically in jeopardy because the Cro-Mags were going to take over the whole thing. So I love that it just creates content that you wouldn't even think of because you're not boxed in.
Right. You know what I think is fascinating about multiverses in general is I've talked to other film buffs and whatnot in recent times, especially since Spider-Man came out, and that really kind of amplified the multiverse, and Into the Spider-Verse did too, the whole multiverse concept. And they were acting like this is new. Marvel like created this whole idea. I'm like, man, there have been stories like this being told for decades. What are you talking about? It's exploding in popularity maybe right now, because I think people are running out of ideas. I mean, you can just tell by the amount of remakes we have, but this is not a new concept. This has been around for some time.
It's like Marvel's Apple and can't do any wrong.
It's true. That's so true. You know, would you guys consider the Tarantino revisionist history kind of a multiverse? You know,
absolutely.
Inglourious Basterds and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Absolutely. I think both of them are a multiverse kind of movie. They play with the idea of what if. Inglourious Basterds, what if you sent a bunch of psychopaths into Germany and they actually succeeded at killing Hitler? Django Unchained, you know, what if this whole thing? Like, I guess it's more of like, I don't know if that's really revisionist, but
that one's
definitely
not revisionist. That's more of a just fictional storytelling.
Yeah. But yeah, definitely Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That's the movie, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What the hell's wrong with my brain? Anyhow.
We're in the alternate universe where it stopped working, I guess. Where you have...
I guess.
That's what you get for making bad jokes earlier in the show. This is what happens.
What?
Yeah. Karma. I think it's called karma. I don't believe in karma, but I think it's hitting you anyway.
Say it ain't so, Aaron.
I think the other cool aspect is spirituality. And any kind of like spiritual realm concepts that you would run into, think like Stranger Things is one that comes to mind, with the Upside Down.
The Upside Down, yeah.
Another great one is Awake. It was a one season TV series police drama, but he literally was, you know, fluctuating back and forth in his own mind between what was real and what wasn't as he was dealing with this kind of like illness that he had in his brain. Leftovers. What's that?
The OA.
Yeah, very similar. Same thing. Leftovers, again, very spiritual in that regard. It's just a lot of cool stuff that you get to play with because you're not boxed into the standard way of the world working.
Now, another question I have is, do you think it's fair to constantly have multiverses at our narrative beck and call? Or do you think sometimes it's just an easy answer to never kill a character or make for the easy redemption because you can just go to a different world and pluck them from there?
Well, I mean, for me, I think the hard part about this is I love the concept when it's done right and when it's the character and the driving force of the program or the movie. When you're using it as the gimmick, I think is where it suffers, right? Because you're saying, oh, because we have a multiverse, we can bring Superman back to life. Or, oh, because we got a multiverse, we can, you know, have this most awesomest movie ever that didn't get nominated for an Oscar that literally saved movie theaters. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's a fun moment, but it's a gimmick, right? You don't get three Spider-Man showing up at once unless there's a multiverse. So like that's the part where the multiverse scares me, because you can literally just make up stuff to make your story work versus telling a really good story to begin with in the first place.
And don't you worry about it being confusing for audiences to some degree? I mean, there has to be an aspect of that, because when you have a multiverse, you're having to keep, I mean, you know how it is with Fringe, and I watched most of Fringe. I just didn't finish it, but you've got, you know, okay, that's two worlds. It's a little easier to keep two worlds in mind, you know, with Spider-Man, multiple verses. Doctor Strange, it seems to be going in the same direction where you're going to have multiple verses. Like, I don't want to have to keep track of all this stuff. And I also don't want them to feel like they can just do anything they want and they don't have to follow any kind of rules anymore because they have this wide open multiverse. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like there has to be some kind of set parameters for the stories that they're telling, instead of just, I have to keep track of all this stuff, or you could just do whatever the hell you want. I'm concerned about it. I'm not against it yet. I have concerns about it.
I think it, with anything else, it's a matter of responsibility and in the use of a tool. So, you know, use a tool irresponsibly, it's going to be obvious. Use it responsibly, it's also going to be obvious, but in the positive way. You're going to have people who know exactly how to use it. But at the same time, you got it. You know, you can't treat your audience as if they're all going to be brain dead, you know, toothless weirdos going to the movie theater. Like, treat us like we're smart and make something smart and use it smart, and we'll be okay.
Yeah, I mean, Star Trek, I think, did a really great job in Star Trek Discovery, because Star Trek has always had this concept of the mirrorverse through most of its history. And when Star Trek Discovery comes onto the screen and you're like, okay, well, how are we going to tell a story that's post-Enterprise yet pre-Kirk and actually make it interesting, and how they leverage the mirrorverse in that first season, especially when you see the twist when it happens and you're just kind of like, oh snap,
how
like,
do they,
I did not see that coming.
How do they utilize that? Nobody's gonna go back and watch Discovery right now, but how do they utilize the mirror universe as you saw it?
They actually planted so in the mirror universe, it's called the Terran Empire, and so they've actually planted spies from the Terran Empire on our side of the rift, or whatever you want to call it.
So one universe planted spies in another universe, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you don't know it, because they obviously look exactly the same.
Sounds
as
like
you.
Fringe.
It does sound like Fringe, yeah.
But when it's tied into the negotiations that they're having around the Klingons, and how the Klingon houses are finally coming together for the first time to become the Klingon Empire, and they're trying to like disrupt that and disable that, I think that makes just for a fascinating story, because it's a story we've never seen before in Star Trek lore.
That sounds interesting. All right, so where do you guys see this going in terms of taking storytelling to a different level? I've thought about this, and I'm like, this would be really cool if you could move it into genres that it normally wouldn't be in. I would like to see a Western multiverse in some aspect. You know, I think that could be very cool. You have, you know, maybe the same time frame with different levels of advancement, civilization advancement. So there's different technologies and whatnot. I would like to see something like that. Like, where do you see, what kinds of things could you see happening with the storytelling, with the multiverse as a concept?
I don't know if I'd want something like a Western. It just seems kind of cheesy, no offense. But
you shut up. You just bitched. You just raved about a mirror ball or whatever. Disco universe, whatever the hell that was. The YMCA, the Village People universe.
The YMCA.
Disco was the short name for Discovery, so that is true.
So funny.
The one that really struck me, I think, from a multiverse perspective, was a show called Devs, D-E-V-S. It was 8 episodes, FX on Hulu.
That's the Alex Garland show.
Alex Garland. And, I mean, we all know how much we loved, you know, Ex Machina. Mm-hmm. And most of what Garland does, you know, we've pretty much raved about it here on The Hollywood Outsider. But Devs was such an interesting show, because it's not that there was a multiverse per se. It was more around the concept of predestination. So if I take a step, was that step predetermined that I was going to take that step? Or if I would have stepped 2 centimeters to the left or 2 centimeters to the right, what kind of permutations of universes could exist? And they were building tech to be able to see those other scenarios and those other universes, so that they could then install themselves into the perfect utopia path. And I think that's the stuff that you just kind of go like, man, like religion, spirituality, existence, like all the big questions that we have about life in general. And then you start trying to piece that together in some plausible way. That's fascinating to me. You know, Westerns where they use Nerf guns instead of bullets, like not so much.
I don't know why you hate Westerns, but fine.
You know, I think about this like like a spy thriller done this way would be kind of cool. There's actually a show called Counterpart that stars J.K. Simmons that executes it pretty well as far as a multiverse idea of a universe where you got J.K. Simmons on one side of one universe and he's kind of this like bookish, nerdy guy. Exactly what J.K. Simmons can do, but then his counterpart on the other side is actually like a super spy, and again, exactly what J.K. Simmons can do pretty well. Mm-hmm. I like that aspect of doing things as far as finding a way to use that storytelling to do it. But what I think a great tool in the multiverse is it's a great way to first ground your character. So you can come in, ground your character in one way, and then slip them into the multiverse to then open up the world to yourself, to the viewer, and really take them on a trip through, you know, whether it's a space adventure or whether it's a adventure in a different version of Earth or even a different planet. But using the multiverse that way to kind of ground them and then take them on a trip.
When you said spy thriller, I was kind of thinking to myself, does Tenet work? Is Tenet a multiverse because of the ability to go backwards, even though you're in the same reality?
That's interesting because you at one point in the film, you definitely have the same character on both sides, right?
Yeah.
Right. Engaging each other. So I would say yes. To a degree, wouldn't you? I mean, if the character is fighting himself, wouldn't that be a multiverse?
Yeah, technically it is because one character is moving forward, the other character is moving backwards. And again, that's another movie that actually takes the concept, turns it on its side a little bit and turns into something that's pretty fantastic. And, you know, the whole trick of that movie is pretty well done.
I love the idea. I think there's so many ways that they could take these things. I get concerned about Marvel's uses of it. But then every time I get really concerned about the multiverse as a concept, because I just don't want to have to think that hard. I see something like, you know, Everything Everywhere All at Once, where they're utilizing the full potential of what the multiverse concept can utilize. And, you know, you're seeing one actor portray 10 different roles. And I'm like, that's fascinating if you do it right. They, in my opinion, managed to do it right. But, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of filmmakers that are going to do that way wrong. I just don't want it to be like this get out of jail free card where story doesn't matter anymore. There are no more stakes because it's too easy to just pluck a character from a different multiverse and bring them back. Look, character's still alive. See, we just went and stole that kid from the other universe. Yay, he's alive. You know, I want stakes to matter. I want real heart and actual consequences for actions. I think that's important in storytelling. I worry that the multiverse concept is going to kind of be a little too forgiving for some kinds of films.
Warner Brothers actually is a perfect example as far as the CW shows, a perfect example of how the multiverse is actually being abused because for all those reasons, Superman's dead over here. Well, let's just bring him back over here from this universe. And, you know, this character's dead over here. Well, here he is again. Like there's a lot of that happens over there and it makes it really hard to watch because of the complete overuse of it with those shows on CW. I'm not saying DC can't make a good show. I'm just saying those CW shows abuse the crap out of the multiverse.
They had a good 3 or 4 years and now it's ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah. It's pretty just crazy at this point.
The exception that makes a rule? Is that what I'm looking for?
Yeah. Feels right.
Yeah.
It's good. Got 3 listener comments I want to mention. We post the topic in our group and we kind of ask listeners what they think. Stuart Bannerman said, I am not a fan. And we're just asking, what do you think of the multiverse concept? I am not a fan. Having to make sure I see every film or show and in the right order drives me nuts. The shared universe multiverse was fun to begin with, but it's become as annoying as post-credit sequences. What do you guys say to that?
Post-credit sequences are amazing. You shut up.
Not in Morbius, they're not. Just saying.
You had to make it that far first.
That's fair. Touche. They should have put those in the beginning. Better likelihood that people will watch them.
You know, I guess what I can say to that is that you know, ultimately he sums it up pretty well himself. He's not a fan of it, but there is a group of people. It's not something that's made specifically for Stuart. I'm sorry, Stuart. It is something that's made for a greater mass than that. And you'll find there's people who are fans of things and there's people who are not fans of things. I tend to find them to be enjoyable. Troy just says they're enjoyable. I do think the idea of the multiverse can be abused. Like I pulled up with Warner Brothers, did it with CW shows, but overall I like the concept. But I get it. I get what his concern is.
Yeah. The way Stuart's pointing it out here though, is he's also talking about individual shows and individual properties making up the multiverse. So you'd have to see them in a particular order. I think that's a load of crap.
Yeah, right? I do too.
Yeah. Use the multiverse in a singular movie for the movie concept, or a singular TV series for a TV series concept. But if you start saying like, oh, this movie happened, oh, here's a great example, like the multiverse of Fast and the Furious where Han's alive, like that's dumb.
That's the only way that some bitch lived. It had to be a multiverse.
The only way. It is 100% a multiverse by episode 9.
It's so funny. Yeah, I don't like that. I've never liked that concept. I want the ability to not watch certain characters I don't care about. And I shouldn't have to skip, even though I like Moon Knight, I shouldn't have to skip a show like Moon Knight or, you know, and be punished when I go see Doctor Strange. Like, if it's very pivotal to Doctor Strange, I don't think that's fair. I don't think it's fair as a fan. So far, it hasn't really been the case, but I know that that's what they're building to, and I don't think that is fair as a fan. So I'm with him on that. Drew Ross says, I like it, especially when you don't know what to expect. Creators could do some pretty creative stuff. I'm pumped for Doctor Strange and who might show up in the film. Yeah, you're probably going to get Ben Affleck as Daredevil or something.
That would be amazing.
Would it?
Daredevil? Come on, it'd be great.
Okay. Stefan Smidebeck says, if the story is good and is held together, makes sense and timelines and stuff don't make it messy, then it's all right. The new Spider-Man did it really well, but it probably works due to the heavy fan service that they deliver. So do you think Spider-Man, if they wouldn't have had so much fan service, if they just stuck with the multiple villains and everything, do you think that would have worked as well without all the heavy fan service?
I don't think that bringing the three Spider-Mans was fan service, though. The movie was, the story of the movie was, I need people to forget who I am, so create this spell. The spell is what created the multiverse, which made the opportunity for three Spider-Mans to show up. Now, granted, everybody might have wanted the three Spider-Mans to be there. And yeah, maybe that was a fan request, but it wasn't like three Spider-Mans show up, build a story around it. I don't think that's how it went. I think they truly went because they had the starting point at the end of the second movie, right? It's like, oh, Peter Parker's identity is out there. Let's mm-hmm. build a movie off of Peter Parker's identity is out there. And how do we reverse that? I think that's the case. So I think that it was great. It was a great movie across the board. And they finally got the whole emotional impact that we've been missing with No Uncle Ben.
We should note, this is just to close this out. We've had this debate. We had a big, long conversation about it a month or two ago about the whole Daredevil not being canon, according to Marvel. Well, they've reversed that decision, and now they say that Daredevil is canon. And I'm like, you don't have to say that publicly, because we saw Spider-Man. He's in the movie. He's canon. It's just like, okay. I just don't understand. And I love that fans are saying, well, they came out and said it, so now he's canon. I'm like, bitch, did you see the movie? They don't have to say shit. He's canon. I don't understand. Ah! As we alluded to, we are talking about 80s soundtracks. With Top Gun reigniting the 80s, I mean, he brought Danger Zone back in that movie, which was exciting to hear Kenny Loggins again because he was the king of the 80s. And we're going to talk a little bit about 80s soundtracks as a whole. And if you really think on it, I would argue, because I'm from that era, that the 80s had the best era of movie soundtracks, or at least definitely songs, but had a lot of fantastic soundtracks, with the original Top Gun right at the top. And I spent a lot of time looking at different various polls of the top soundtracks of the 80s, and it seems Top Gun is right there at the top. Danger Zone, Take My Breath Away, you know, it's probably neck and neck with Dirty Dancing for the top spot, mostly because they let Patrick Swayze sing. We don't know why, but they did. And first, I want to define what a soundtrack is, because that seems to be a little bit of confusion for a lot of people. A soundtrack is a collection of songs that put you in the movie's mood, that are from the movie or about the movie or reflect the movie, not necessarily a score. It's not about a score. It's about the songs that are collected on a soundtrack. And Stand By Me is a great example, because Stand By Me is a film that had a fantastic soundtrack, but the songs weren't actually from that era, but they reflected the movie that they were telling, the story that they were telling. So it's a great soundtrack. Everybody agree on that? Or does anybody feel different about that? How do you feel?
No, I feel like that's pretty wrong. A soundtrack can still encompass like just orchestral music that is a score. I think the difference in what we're talking about is we are not referring to a score soundtrack, because there are some movies where they don't have songs, they only have a score, which is just the actual music. This has lyrical accompaniment with the sound of the music, the instruments. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a movie soundtrack that has the songs with lyrics that, like Aaron's talking about, describe the movie, talk about the movie, reflect the movie, just get you in the mood for the movie.
Get you in the mood.
Yeah, but I think that we can still say that there's soundtracks that exist that don't have lyrical songs. They just have a score.
They got to have some songs for me. I can't just, if it's just the score, then that's just the score. To me, I don't.
But it's still a soundtrack. Maybe,
but in my brain, it doesn't count. It doesn't count. Soundtrack to me is a collection of songs. It's the track of sounds. With words, I don't know. That's just how my brain defines it. But that's what we are talking about.
I think people blend it these days, though, because sometimes, I think in the past, it was the soundtrack was only the songs that were sung by artists that you could hear on the radio.
Right.
And then the musical score was like a two volume of all the instrumentals.
They always called it
the score. I think today they started to blend them together a little bit. You might get two or three or four of the big hits mixed in with some of the background music that's on that particular album. I think what's interesting about music in the movies specifically is that there's like two different types of music. There's something called diegetic music. This is music that's actually heard, like you're in, the characters actually hear the music in the movie. So think like I'm driving in the car and I pop a song on the radio, or when Marty McFly wakes up to the alarm clock, like that type of music is diegetic. So the character is actually hearing that song as well as the audience, versus something that's just incidental or underscoring where it would be in the background. I think some of the best soundtracks probably use more of the incidental music, unless it's like ramping up to pump you up into something. Thinking like Living in America, for example, from Rocky IV, which we'll get into in a little bit, I think is a really great use of like pumping up the audience, but it's not actually heard in the actual movie itself by the characters.
Oh yeah, because Rocky was famous.
Where Power of Love is on the radio when Marty wakes up in the morning, so it's actually heard by Marty McFly inside the movie, which is diegetic then.
And another differentiation is, while a soundtrack that contains songs can have songs that didn't even play in the movie, a soundtrack or whatever Aaron wants to call it, an album that just has the score
album.
On it, that just has a score on it, the score will only include stuff that was played during the movie, the music that played during the movie. So you'll never hear a score in the soundtrack that was not actually played during the movie. But you can have songs on there that weren't.
And you got to remember, the credits are part of the movie. Don't just skip out and leave because the credits show up on the screen. Pay appreciation to the people that are there, because the song in the credits is always on the soundtrack.
Wow. Got scolded.
I was going to say, I feel like I just got lectured for doing something wrong.
I know. I saw all those people stand up at the end of Top Gun. They were like, aftercredits.com. Nope, nope. Okay, we out. Peace. Got to go to the bathroom. Aaron was one of those people.
I had to pee, man. I left. Yeah, I bolted. I'm not going to lie. My breath was being taken away because I had to hold it, so I didn't pee.
Do you think there's a count out there for the original Top Gun of how many times they played that song in the movie, though?
Which one?
Take My Breath Away.
In the first movie or any?
Yeah.
What do you mean a count?
They reuse that song like 14 different times.
I mean,
well, that's a really great, it's an observational piece, because sometimes when you write music for a movie, you're actually using pieces of that song. A great one is The Karate Kid. the three notes, do 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 do, like that is actually in the song, that is actually in the end credits sequence, actually, and then they built the entire motif. So as you listen to some of the scoring or the incidental music that's in the background, you'll hear that in Daniel's theme, like when he goes from his hometown to Reseda as they're traveling across the country. You'll hear those three notes actually played inside of that song as they travel. And so you use some of that to score specific moments or feelings. And then eventually you'll hear it later on. A really great example of this is Return of the King, Lord of the Rings, when they're on the side of the mountain and Sam is the whole, like, you know, I can't carry it for you, but I can carry you. And you hear this like, bum, 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 French horn comes in, like real powerful. And then that ends up being Annie Lennox's Into the West, which is played at the end of the movie over the credits.
Yeah, very astute you are. When you were talking about the score and soundtrack differences and how now they're called the same thing, I'm wondering, like, was a composer offended or something? And he's just like, you call my score a soundtrack. It's the same thing to me. It's the only thing I could think of.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, here's your $5 pay to the jar for Troy's Blacklist podcast comment. But they actually did release a soundtrack for the Blacklist for season one. And then they actually released Dave Porter does all of the underscoring for the show. And when they did the release Dave Porter's album, it was called the Blacklist score by Dave Porter, not the soundtrack.
They did that with Miami Vice, too, in the 80s.
Yeah.
So that's not the first time, man. That's always been a thing. All right. So back on the 80s, think back on that decade. And it's going to be interesting because, you know, Troy and I are from that decade. Amanda, I dare think you are not. You're 90s.
How did I know my age was going to come up in here?
No, it's just a fair, I think it'll be interesting because your choices may be different because the movies are more like you saw them after they came out. And I don't know if that makes a difference.
Full disclosure, almost all of my first choices are Troy's. So what I think's funny about that is that.
Oh, he'd already taken
even though
them?
I didn't, huh?
He had already taken them. Is that what you're saying?
He did. But what I mean to imply by that is that even though I didn't grow up in the 80s, because those movies and soundtracks were so iconic, they became iconic for later generations too. Like they persisted the sands of time. So younger generations to yours and Troy's still cling to the same soundtracks. They still say, no, this is superior to all the others.
Well, most of mine people probably don't know very well, but
that's probably true because you like more obscure stuff. And different stuff.
I like,
but it's interesting because Amanda is enjoying the music from the movies because of the movie, where Aaron and I most likely heard the songs first and foremost on the actual radio, and then saw the movie and went, "Oh, hey, that's that song from the radio."
You know, that is a good point. There
not for
are
me.
Some
not for me, not for me. I was a movie obsessive. Most of the music I listened to was either rap or from movies. That's how I grew up. Sorry.
I definitely identified, or, you know, I will think back and say, oh, I recognize this song, or I know this song, or I love this song because of the first time I heard it in this movie. And I think that's what Troy is saying, at least for mine and his experience, is that he may have heard it on the radio and then he's watching the movie and he's like, oh, yeah, I know the song. I can't believe they put this in here, versus me, who's like, I might hear it years later on the radio or somewhere else. And I'm like, oh, that takes me back to the time I watched XYZ movie, you know, sure, Breakfast Club or whatever. The song and the movie are synonymous together for me personally.
And I think that's an interesting juxtaposition because, like, even though I heard Power of Love, Huey Lewis in the News on the radio first, then saw Back to the Future. Now, if you talk to me today, I would say, oh, yeah, it's that song from Back to the Future. It's not that song from Huey Lewis in the News. Mm-hmm. So it's a testament to say, like, how good that song was in the movie that you've now disassociated it from the album and actually tied it to the movie even later after you've actually heard it from the album the first time.
That's interesting.
And I think that's where a lot of where we come to the thought of one-hit wonders from these songs on these soundtracks. Some of them have other hits that did well, but because they just, none of their songs stood to the same level that they did when they had, you know, Power of Love, let's say, in a movie in Back to the Future. It's just not the same. They don't have anything that gets to that same level. Very rarely, if you have a super big hit in a movie, a song that gets into a movie and it becomes synonymous with the movie. Do you have another song, a different song, different movie, same movie, whatever, that is equitable, that is just as well known, that is just as popular? Like, it just doesn't happen. And so when those movies have their quote unquote one hit wonders, I feel like those artists kind of peak.
See, you guys are making me feel super weird because when in the 80s, particularly, because that's you know, my as a kid growing into my teens, I didn't listen to the radio hardly ever. I mean, we were very, very poor. So I listened to the music that was around me, which was typically rap or movies, because I was obsessed with movies. So I usually learned about the songs from the movie. Power of Love, learned from the movie. I mean, all the songs that you're going to talk about, I saw the movie first, most likely, before I ever heard them on a radio, because I really didn't listen to much radio. I read more than I read, watched movies, but I watched so many movies. And I almost every freaking album that I had, or cassette tape, to be perfectly honest, with cassette tape, they were soundtracks. Almost my entire collection for most of the 80s were soundtracks. Like, that's what I listened to. I know more songs from movies than I know from just genuine pop radio, which is probably not the norm, but that's how I grew up. So I can identify. I mean, I love so many weird, weird little songs from movies. I mean, I was going through all this and there were so many, just like so many soundtracks. I wish we had a 6-hour episode, because I would actually probably dive into a bunch of them, but that's more like independent songs. So I had made it a little easier to narrow it down to soundtracks I love. But all the ones that I grew up on with, man, I never heard on the radio. I mean, I would hear them on the radio like after the fact, maybe if we were in the car or something, but they didn't register with me until I had seen the movie. So I'm sure I'm different, but I was also a huge, huge cinephile, and probably creepily so. My God, I watched too much. You know what I'm saying? So let's get into it. Troy, start us off. Tell us your five, like, top soundtracks from the 80s. What do you think are the top soundtracks? And we'll, you know, take a breath before each one so we can actually discuss if we want to.
Okay, so all five.
Yeah, just to your
rather than going round robin. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think Top Gun obviously is number one for sure. But if there was a very close second, it would have to be Back to the Future, because it has been deemed like almost the perfect movie in most circles, and the soundtrack is no exception. I mean, it's really clever when you think about how the soundtrack came together in the first place, because Huey Lewis in the News, who actually wrote Power of Love and then was later asked to write Back in Time for the end credits, they never actually wanted to write for film and actually turned the project down originally. They only said, fine, well, whatever song we write next, we'll just give to the movie. So that's why the Power of Love doesn't have any reference to anything about the movie at all, other than maybe very loosely Marty and Jennifer's connection. But for the most part, Power of Love has nothing to do with the film. It was just the next song that Huey Lewis and the News wrote and gave it to Silvestri and the group in order to put it into the composition. And then when they sang Johnny Be Good at the end of the flick, which is actually, you know, Chuck Berry's song, in this version on the soundtrack, it's actually Marty McFly and Curtis Williams and the Starlighters that are singing it. And they didn't actually want to give Curtis Williams the credit for singing the vocal, because they wanted to make sure people thought it was actually Fox that sang on stage. So Curtis actually doesn't get the credit for the vocals on that particular track on the soundtrack.
That's interesting.
That's a shame right there, because A, nobody thought that Fox was singing that, unless you were not a very intelligent person at the time, which is possible. Hey, it's the 80s, a lot of cocaine going on, crack, you know, I don't know. So I thought that was a little, that's messed up. That's all I could say about that. That's messed up.
But at least they were honorable to the time period, because Johnny B. Goode doesn't actually come out from Chuck Berry until 1958, 3 years after his cousin gives him a phone call in the movie.
So ridiculous.
How do you guys feel about the music that's crafted for a movie versus them just pulling songs to make a full soundtrack? Like, I'm more impressed by a soundtrack that has, if it's really well done and they made created songs for the movie, because I feel like that's much more difficult to find hits that can resonate with people versus pulling some of the best songs and, you know, people are going to jive to it. Jive. I'm like in the 60s right now.
Yeah, man. It's more 70s. But I definitely prefer when they write them for the movie, because then I feel like there's a connection But, you know, you can't go wrong with a good collection of songs, no matter where they're from. And if you get introduced to new songs, like I had never heard Johnny Be Good up until Back to the Future, even though I still think it's messed up that they're implying that Marty McFly is the reason why he got it. That's just weird. But I don't think that scene would happen today, and it probably shouldn't. But I love a good collection of songs, and, you know, that always works well for me. But on the same token, I love when they craft them. When you're making a song directly for a movie, or a song that wasn't popular and just blends into the movie you're making, because that happens a lot more than you think. Too often people think, well, that song was written for the movie. Not really. They just went and found a bunch of songs, kind of like Troy was talking about Blacklist and Miami Vice. That's a lot of what they did, was they went and curated songs that were already existing that fit their narrative, fit their mood, fit the vibe, and then it became a soundtrack.
But you think of something like Once, Falling Slowly, where that was written to be part of the movie. Like the whole movie was kind of crafted around that song, almost like A Star Is Born too.
Or like any James Bond movie.
Or any ever. James Bond movie, yeah. Where the title song is literally crafted for the particular title that they're actually making that particular time.
Yeah. Okay, so Back to the Future, that's a good one. It's a nice collection of song, original and existing songs.
I know that it's probably not the most common take, but I would actually say that is superior to Top Gun.
Definitely not a popular take.
I know.
And that's why I said Top Gun is number one, but Back to the Future is a very close second.
I'll give you a better hot take. I think Back in Time is a better song than Power of Love.
You know why? Because Back in Time was written for the movie and the movie story.
To me, I love the movie vibe of it. Power of Love doesn't really fit anything in the movie, except unless you want to talk about Marty's mom wanting to bang him, I guess. But Back in Time, I love that song. I think it's a great movie song. So
I'm glad you heard it, because it only plays during the credits and you would have left and went to the bathroom at that point.
I had that soundtrack, son. I had that soundtrack. Don't get mad at me. I had to pee. What do you want me to do? I had to pee. Maverick was on screen for 2 hours. I sat through Miles goddamn Teller. I did everything I had to do, all right? Except pee.
Also, Aaron, aren't you typically the type to never leave before the end of the credits?
I never leave before the end of the credits. But I really, really, we went and had a few cocktails before we went to the movie. And that was a mistake. And I won't make it again anytime soon-ish. All right. Back to the Future. What's next? What else you got?
Ghostbusters comes up next. Good old 1984. Soundtrack includes a Billboard Hot 100 number one hit, Ghostbusters, and performed by Ray Parker Jr., which is interesting because there were like hundreds of submissions for the Ghostbusters song in that part of the film where the montage happens. And surprisingly enough, the one that was going to be there prior to Ray Parker Jr. was I Want a New Drug from Huey Lewis in the News.
Yeah, which Ghostbusters stole from.
Yeah.
A little bit.
So apparently you're just a Huey Lewis fan. That's what you're saying. Not a little bit. He won a lot. They won a lawsuit against
Huey Lewis.
Like they said, Ray Parker, you stole our song. And he's like, no, I didn't.
Oh, I know.
Oh man. Yeah. Totally stole it. But yeah. Can we ask you, you use that as a soundtrack. Now I'll give you Ghostbusters, one of the most famous movie songs of all time. But as a soundtrack, do you like all the songs? I mean, I do like a couple of them on there for sure.
Yeah. Thompson Twins is on there, right? In the Name of Love. You got Hot Night from Diane Warren and Laura Branigan. And then you got the standard Ghostbusters version. And then you also got the instrumental theme of Ghostbusters, which is really cool. But then you also got Cleaning Up the Town by the Bus Boys. I mean, all good fun songs that you can just like jam out to if you got them playing on repeat in the background.
For sure. Just checking. I was just making sure that you weren't just like, you're just a huge fan of that one song.
No. Magic's good too from Mick Smiley. Next one I have is The Lost Boys. I mean, just the moodiness of this entire album, I think, is really, really great.
Sax Man. It's got Sax Man in it. I still believe. Yeah.
Tim Capello.
That's a perfect choice. I love the Lost Boys soundtrack.
Best song on it. What's the best song in your opinion?
People Are Strange is good.
That is a good one. I don't know. I'm real bad about choosing favorites for anything.
Well, that's too bad, because I will tell
That's why I have honorable mentions.
I mean, Cry Little Sister is the theme, so I mean, I feel like you have to pick that one. Sister.
Yep, and that would be one where you heard the music throughout, like as a bit of a background theme. Good Times is one of my favorite songs of the 80s from NXS and Jimmy Barnes.
Oh, yeah, Jimmy Barnes, mm-hmm. Yeah.
NXS is probably one of my all-time favorite bands. I don't talk about them enough, but I freaking love NXS.
And so you loved 80s movies then, because they were in like a lot of them?
They were, but I saw them in concert, man. Michael Hutchence was he was one of the best showmen I've ever seen. But
really?
Good, yes.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
Fantastic. He writhed around kind of like Axl Rose, but with rhythm. And Good Times is just one of those songs where anytime I hear it, I'm instantly smiling. It's just, it puts me in a great mood every single time. I need to hear it more often. Sorry, I didn't mean to hijack your love, but
not at all. All right. Next one then I have is obviously Rocky IV, because I mean, living in America, sing it all the time. So good. So good. And what's funny is that people think, when they think Rocky IV, they think Eye of the Tiger was on this album, which it is, but technically Eye of the Tiger actually was made famous in Rocky III prior to being Rocky IV. But Rocky IV is where it actually gets the most like play up, you know, during the whole training sequence and everything. And then, of course, Hearts on Fire from John Cafferty is just a really good song, too.
That's a great soundtrack. And you're right. Eye of the Tiger, most people get that wrong, that it's part of Rocky IV, just because I think that's the more preferred movie. But it's from a montage in Rocky III, and it's one of the best running songs.
It is also on the soundtrack in Rocky IV, so you're not wrong by saying it's on the Rocky IV soundtrack. It just also was on the Rocky III soundtrack first.
Catch 22 is what that is.
Famous.
It's a trick. Amanda, has your generation seen any of the Rocky movies, or just Creed?
Oh, for sure. You know, honestly, I think a lot of I didn't really like watching the Rocky movies because I don't like boxing. It makes me sad and it makes me cry. So I always had a hard time with that. But I, growing up, always had friends who really liked Rocky. I think because of like the survivalist story, and also just it was a very machismo story that dudes could connect with and also feel like there's some heroism in it. A lot of the 80s. And even 90s, 70s to 90s movies where men were the dominant focus of the film. And there was a lot of action and all of that, something for the men to connect with. It was violent for not their choice. It was violent for violence sake or violence for war, things like that. This was more of a man taking his own ownership. So I think men kind of finally had something to connect to where it was more heroic. That's my own opinion. They liked it.
That's fair to agree. It's a great underdog story, too, or at least the first movie is.
And yeah.
I don't know how he can still be an underdog when he's a champion in the second and third and fourth and whatever.
But. Because he was the underdog to begin with and he just continued. I don't know. I guess so. But I see your point.
He lost in the first one. That's the thing people always forget. They think Rocky was a winner all the time. No, first movie he lost. So he wasn't a winner until Rocky II. But after that, it's not an underdog story anymore, as far as I'm concerned. All right, so what else you got?
I got a final one. Number 5 is, of course, The Breakfast Club, which honestly is a horrible soundtrack. It really is.
No, it's not.
But
disagree, yeah. Troy Heinrichs. Hard disagree.
It's not like you put it on and want to play it all the time. It makes the list specifically because, as a Gen Xer, Simple Minds, Don't You Forget About Me, is the quintessential anthem for the generation. So that song is on the soundtrack, it like redeems itself. But I mean, if you actually listen to the whole soundtrack, I mean,
it's got Wang Chung, man. In the world. It's got Wang Chung in it. It's automatically awesome.
But it's not like the songs from Wang Chung that you would know.
Not the songs you would know. I know the songs. Right. That was a great soundtrack. It's a good soundtrack with a fantastic song.
Yes. And also, this is the perfect example of how a song can literally make or break your movie, because the way that you use the score and the songs that you put into your movie can drive people emotionally. And it was, I mean, just everyone, when his fist went in the air and that song is playing, you immediately wanted to like jump out of your seat or jump off your couch, wherever you watched it you watched it. You wanted to change the world. You wanted to show people what you're made of.
I want to do it right now.
I know. And like every time I hear that song, I can literally see him putting his fist in the air. Like
every time you hear that song, you want to put your fist in the air. I don't care what it's about. You know, you could be at the grocery store and all of a sudden, if it comes on the intercom, you will see someone put their fist up. You will see some, and you'll just wish you had a trench coat on.
And I think that makes it one of the most iconic uses of music in a movie.
I would agree with that.
Because it is, it's not only that the song is now synonymous with the movie, the song is synonymous with a particular scene, a particular moment within a scene. Like, that is incredibly difficult to do.
John Hughes, where people
hear that and they're just like in that exact moment, that exact space. Like, I have a horrible, terrible memory, but I will never not picture that entire moment in my head when I hear the song.
Yeah, it stands for overcoming my past trauma. It stands for overcoming high school. It stands for overcoming the patriarchy. It stands for just, you know, good friends and good bonding. I mean, it just symbolizes so much in that motion. That's just like, yeah, and you want to have that legacy that comes behind all of that when you end up walking off the field.
Yeah, I was Bender when I was in high school.
But you're not feeling that with We Are Not Alone from Carla DeVito or Didn't I Tell You from Lori Horsey.
No, I get
you. I mean, they're good songs, but it's not like you're like, oh, I got to go run to the Breakfast Club soundtrack to play Waiting by Elizabeth Daly.
Here's the important thing about that soundtrack that you're missing is that Breakfast Club, the reason why it's so good is because it was representing various classes of your typical high school, and each of the song is a different element of those particular classes. So it,
for sure,
it's a good soundtrack in that it mixes and meshes a lot of various styles of song, and that's why it's so good. Good collection, man.
But you only get that association to the movie. You're not just getting it from the soundtrack listening itself.
I mean, I get it. I mean, they're connected, but that's what a soundtrack does, right? But
like, where you could just put on the Back to the Future soundtrack and just play the Back to the Future soundtrack.
God, I had a weird Judd Nelson obsession when I was younger because of that movie. Because I wore a trench coat. I was a freaking rebel.
I was gonna say, was it a Judd Nelson or was it a trench coat obsession? That's really what the
all the
is.
Above. Because I went and saw Blue City, and I went and saw all of his movies after that. So I guess I had a little bit of a Judd Nelson obsession.
Point established.
All right, Amanda, what about your five? What do you got?
My first one is probably one of my favorites. Because, again, it's synonymous with a specific moment in a movie. And it is the soundtrack from Say Anything.
Mm.
And I
your
think for
eyes, the light, the heat, your eyes,
Peter Gabriel, yep. That, I mean, just, it made you also want to cry and do all these things. But also, it had Living Color. Peter Gabriel's in it, Cheap Trick, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Fishbone, like all Soundgarden, Aerosmith. I mean, like endless amazing soundtrack. I loved it so much. And it's just one of those where even if you're not crazy about the movie, because I know a lot of people who are just like, you know, it's a fine movie. That soundtrack makes the movie so much better.
Oh, I want to be begging your ass.
Okay. Next one is Pretty in Pink. This one probably wouldn't have made my top five list.
Well, hang on. I do want to say.
Okay.
Back to Say Anything on a serious note. You mentioned Living Color, Cult of Personality. I think is a song that's on that one.
Yep.
And Living Color. Just so you know, my favorite all time band. True story. That's all I wanted. Hey, continue.
I'm glad you shared that vital piece of information with all of us.
And if you say they only had one album, you're wrong. They had a lot of fantastic albums, and their writing was spectacular. The reason why I love them is because they always had something to say. They didn't just write stupid love songs. So seek them out. They're just one of those bands I wish more people would rediscover their content. Okay, continue. Yeah,
because the movie was 1989. Living Color actually formed in 1984.
Yeah, they've been
there's 5 years of songs from Living Color.
And they had many, many albums after that. They didn't just stop after Vivid, okay? I'm just letting you know, they had a lot of albums. They're still making music today, actually. I bought a new album from them a couple years ago.
What's the song that they wrote for 9/11? That song breaks my heart into little pieces.
There's a couple. I'm trying to think of which one you're talking about.
Where he's talking about how she's in the building and that they were going to be, you know, together. Yeah.
Yes. And Flying.
That's what it is. Flying. Oh my God.
That's a beautiful song.
If you want to cry, listen to that song, Flying by Living Color, and keep in mind that it was written for 9/11, and you'll just spend the day real sad.
And Nothingness is a great song about mental health struggles. Just, you know. See, like all their music, they were saying something. That's why I'm sorry. I totally
went on a
tangent.
This is a podcast now devoted to Living Color.
Yeah. Corey Glover, you're my man if you're listening. Go ahead.
We'll be sure to let him know. Okay, so Pretty in Pink. I mean, John Hughes in general, I feel like pretty much took it away.
Nails it every
with
time.
Everything. Yeah. He doesn't fail. But I really liked the music. Not necessarily where I would take this soundtrack and listen to it in my car as I'm driving down the road or whatever, but it was so perfect for the movie. Every time it had like the perfect vibe, if you will, for Pretty in Pink. And I feel like that is also something very difficult to achieve, to find something where you can feel like when you're listening to the music, oh, this is the movie. This is a representation sure. of the movie.
Had NXS on it too, just so you know.
Mm-hmm. It did. Do what you do.
Yep. Do what you do. And it's spelled wrong, and I don't know why, but
we don't need English. It's fine.
I know.
So the next one I think will be on a lot of people's lists, and that's Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Oh, so good. Yeah.
I mean, you have the Go-Go's, Jimmy Buffett, you have Oingo Boingo, you have Billy Squire, all these amazing Stevie Nicks, all these amazing songs and artists. And again, this is like the, I can't remember what the word is, penultimate? I don't know what the word is. Yes. It's such a great representation of like pop punk, which fit the bill for this movie. And because we're, you know, what the movie is about, it makes you want to feel like you're going through a lot of different emotions. Again, yeah. A lot of different genres and types of music. And it's a lot of like faster music, which I felt like high school was very just like one thing to the next, and your mind's kind of racing, your emotions are racing. And so the way that they used it and how they compiled it was fantastic.
It was also a time period where I think when you're talking about being in high school and transitioning out of high school and all those life changes, music itself was kind of having that kind of shift in 1982 where you see in John Hughes films come 84, 85, 86, you get the new wave kind of style of music happening in the mid 80s. This was kind of that shift from the 70s disco into that new wave as you pick up bands like Oingo Boingo, for example, where you're trying to blend the two styles. You get a lot of that on this particular soundtrack.
Oingo Boingo is, I don't know how many people know about that one, but Danny Elfman was the lead in Oingo Boingo, who went on to become one of the most famous movie composers of all time. Fun fact.
He is so talented. Yeah. And he has a song on my next one.
Well, hang on. Also, fun fact, I do not believe that the best song in Fast Times at Ridgemont High is actually on the soundtrack, and that would be the movie, I think it's Moving in Stereo, the cars. That's the pool scene. That's the Phoebe Cates.
Ooh, you're right.
And let's be clear that Danny Elfman also made like the best movie and best soundtrack of all time, which is The Nightmare Before Christmas, and voiced Jack Skellington.
He's so multi-talented. It's insane.
But Oingo Boingo was the bomb in the 80s, man. Weird Science. There's a 7-minute version of that is fantastic, yeah. By the way.
So here's what we need to do. We need to make like a Nightmare Before Christmas type movie, but use like all those classics, like Dead Man's Party.
Oingo Boingo song.
Weird Science.
That would be fantastic.
Who could ask for more?
I love this idea. Okay, so speaking of our dude, Danny Elfman, he has a song called Gratitude on the next album that I selected, which I know Aaron's going to want to talk a lot about, so I'll keep my words brief. Beverly Hills Cop. You've got Junior, Patti LaBelle, and you've got Shalimar, Don't Get Stopped in Beverly Hills. Again, I mentioned Danny Elfman. It's a solid album. And also, I feel like a lot of songs that weren't super popular in Hollywood necessarily, sure, that they were incorporating here and mainstreamed them. Oh, and I love that.
Man, the heat is on. I probably listened to a bazillion times. The heat is on. Down the street. But I listened to that soundtrack, you're right, man, over and over and over and over and over and over. Axel F counts as a song to me. I don't care what anybody says. That's not a theme.
Oh,
song.
It is a song. Yeah. It is like,
and I would actually argue, now this might be I don't want to say hyperbolic, but I would argue that Beverly Hills Cop 2 soundtrack, even better.
I would agree with that statement.
Really? All right, that makes me.
That's also, I think it's also a better movie. Devil Hills Cop 2 is much more fun.
Now you're drunk. That's not the case, but it's still, I love that movie. I don't think it's bad at all. Beverly Hills Cop 3 is garbage, But
yes,
Beverly's Cop 2 was great. And the soundtrack, I Want Your Sex is on there. That's when, my God, when nobody knew George Michael was gay. So then they learned that, like, oh man, I love it. That's not what I thought it was about. Ha ha.
I love that.
It was so fantastic. Shakedown. I could hear that song over and over. Shakedown, Breakdown, Take Down. I would be driving in my car because I think that came out in like the next. No, it was a few
years. As opposed to driving in your wagon?
No,
what else would you be doing in your car?
I'm trying to remember. No, it had to be a bicycle or something, because I remember just like having it on and always going faster, whatever I was doing, skateboarding, bicycle, whatever the hell it was. Years later, I would still play it. I listened to that soundtrack for a decade. I love the second one so much better, I think. But good pick, Amanda. That's the first one's a great soundtrack, too. And Axel F., one of the best theme songs of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Still.
And my last one is from a film called Repo Man.
I can't believe you even know Repo Man, sincerely.
Just because of Emilio Estevez. I always like him. I've always liked him.
Isn't it weird how he was kind of huge and then disappeared and then came back for Mighty Ducks? Now he's gone again. I mean,
it's kind of sad. It makes me sad because I get excited and I get hopeful for him and then nothing really comes of it. And it's also bizarre because I feel like a lot of people get excited for him to come back and make a return, but then it doesn't actually happen. And I don't know where this fall through is happening. I don't know if it's his choice in movies that he's doing, like the Mighty Ducks, or if he's just not getting the offers for other things to make a good return.
Maybe. I mean, God, we keep getting Charlie Sheen back when we don't want him. So
we want the other one.
Yeah, we want the other
one. We want the other one.
Yeah. But Circle Jerks is a great band, right? Coup d'etat, when yeah. shit hits the fan.
Mm-hmm.
Circle Jerks is so good.
Black Flag is on there. I freaking love Black Flag, and I love that they have that on their album.
And Suicidal Tendencies with Institutionalized.
Oh my God, don't get me started on that. Does that count as a song, honestly?
It's so good, though.
It's hilarious. Also, and I did not look into this, but apparently the soundtrack has been removed from Spotify. I want to know why.
Which one?
Repo Man.
It's been removed?
I saw something.
It was repossessed.
Yeah. Stop.
That's amazing.
That's hilarious. What if that is just a stunt, like a play on the name? That's hilarious.
It's funny. I'm sure it's a rights thing. I'm sure. They're like, we want to make more than 3 cents a listen.
Probably. But that's my list.
Okay. I'll knock out the two that people know pretty quick. There's two soundtracks that and this is actually, it's not because you guys stole anything. These are the two that I listened to the most as a kid and probably still have, like, as a continue. But the first one is the Blues Brothers.
Oh, course, excellent choice.
Course. Just nonstop. I continuously listen to that. I love the soundtrack. I love the music. If you actually look into the history, they were really, really particular about ensuring that the original artists actually receive their royalties as per due, unlike, say Back to the Future. They really respected the artists. Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi loved the blues. They loved the artists. They loved the songs. And they brought a lot of that element to pop culture that I don't necessarily felt like it reached pop culture until then. And it really just kind of like blew up in that film. All those artists, I mean, except for Aretha, she was already huge. A lot of the artists specifically were huge, but I just mean like it brought blues music to a whole culture who had never experienced it. And that movie was fantastic, ridiculous, but fantastic. Sequel was awful. But the soundtrack I could just listen to over and over and over and over and over again.
Especially when they redo the theme from Rawhide.
And everything just makes me enjoy that movie so much more. The second one is Purple Rain, which I will tell you what, while I was doing a lot of research and checking out some lists of what people loved and and I would see lists where Purple Rain wasn't even on there. And I just, as far as I'm concerned, it nullified whatever their list was. Because I'm like,
yeah, because Purple Rain should be in the top five.
It should always be in the top. That is one of the best albums of all time.
I was going to say, it's iconic as a separate album itself, like unrelated to a film.
It's crazy how specific and amazing that album was. Tailor made for the movie, sure. But that is a great, fantastic collection of songs by Prince. Let's Go Crazy, Purple Rain, Darling Nikki. I still love Darling Nikki. I don't care how nasty that song is. Like the whole album is perfect.
When the doves cry.
Yep. When the doves cry. Everything on it's a perfect album. It's perfect.
And it's probably one of the only albums that's done soundtrack wise by the same artist for the entire album.
True. I mean, Prince is a musical genius. I mean, the Batman soundtrack, I would actually give him a lot of props for that too. It's unique and it's its own thing. But Purple Rain is just, I mean, seriously, I saw so many lists of soundtracks that didn't have Purple Rain on it, and it just made me want to write a letter to somebody and just scold them for how idiotic their writers are or for how much they lack appreciation for one of the greatest artists of all time. Just insane.
It was also a huge break into mainstream pop culture. Like what? I mean,
He was already huge by then. But
right. But what that album itself did for music, separate from movies, just in entertainment alone, I feel like is such a huge feat that it has to make a list.
What really boggled my mind is that, as famous as he was at the time, and he continued to be for many years after that, he never repeated that, because it's so much talent in that album that I expected Under the Cherry Moon would have the same effect and da-da-da-da, but it just never happened for him again. Like, that was just, for whatever reason, a perfect collection of the best of Prince, I guess.
Yeah, it's like the mountaintop experience, because, like, you can have one, maybe two other good songs later on down the road, but you'll never get, like, a full album where perfection. Everything is a number one.
I can listen to every song on that album without a problem. Jungle Love.
It should also be noted that it inspired the movie. Like, an album inspired a movie. That's how significant and prominent it was.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So the next three, probably less known. One, you'll know one song from it. But these are the other three that I listened to most, especially as a kid. And I was going through them today, and I'm like, God, I still love them. And it's almost shameful. Running Scared, the soundtrack to Running Scared, Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines movie. I love that soundtrack, especially, you know, I remember listening to them on cassette tapes. And Troy, you'll probably understand this more than I think Amanda will. Just because I think you were in the CD era, right?
Yeah, but I still had cassette tapes.
Okay, well, you know how they had like side one and two?
I had like vinyl stuff I had to flip over, man.
Yeah, man. But you know what I'm saying? Like, eight side tracks. One was the better side. Than this side two, or side A and side B. Side A was always better. And Running Scared is just one of those where I always listen to side A, never really listen to side B. But side A, I listen to all the time. Sweet Freedom's on there. The Running Scared song itself is on there. There's a lot of cool songs on there. And
I just want to be loved, ready for the world.
Yes.
Again, man. You got some Patti LaBelle.
She was great, man. She's great. I'm sure she still is great. I don't know if she's still around or not. I hope so.
Kim Wilde was on there too.
Man Size Love, Climax. That was a band that I never heard of again, but that's a great song. So, I mean, a big fan of that one. The next one is a movie I love. I wish more people would see it. I think it's probably hard to find now, but it's Summer School, the Summer School soundtrack.
That's such a great movie. That's a really, really good choice, because it's not going to show up on any of these special lists that you look on online, but it was such a fun soundtrack.
And fun fact that I was today years old when I learned, E.G. Daly, who sang Mind Over Matter and Seduction on that soundtrack. And I had a huge crush on her in the 80s. Huge crush. She's the voice of Tommy Pickles on Rugrats.
What?
What?
True story. She became a very famous voice artist. Mind.
I feel like I just also learned the information that Tommy Pickles was a girl.
So is Bart Simpson, but.
Yeah.
These gender norms have been changing for a while, guys, and we just didn't know it.
Yeah, she's a very talented voice artist, and it's crazy because I was watching the video and I'm like, God, I remember having such a crush on her. And then because I was doing a search, and she came up on, I think it was Kelly Clarkson, and she's like, voice of Tommy Pickles. And I'm like, what? When the hell did that happen? And the whole time. She's always been the voice of Tommy Pickles. I didn't know. And a bunch of other cartoon characters.
Should mention that Danny Elfman is also on the Summer School soundtrack.
He is.
That's how cool Danny Elfman is.
And this is very important. If you go to search, find the Summer School soundtrack. I think it's on YouTube. It's hard to find the actual hard copy anymore. But the happy song you want to hear is the one that's on the YouTube for Summer School soundtrack. Not the Danny Elfman that was released a couple of years ago where he like remastered it. Because that is a weird ass version that is nowhere near the song that I'm talking about. You got to find the Summer School version because it's fun, it's happy, and as all the songs on that soundtrack are. It's just a
he very just performed
soundtrack.
That song at Coachella like a month ago.
Happy?
Mm-hmm.
Did he do the dark and weird version? Because
I don't know.
Coachella, I would assume so.
But probably.
That's just weird.
We all need to go search this now when we finish the podcast.
Seriously, there is a remastered video he did that is freaking weird as hell. So, and because I hadn't heard it in a while, I'm like, I love that song. And I put it on. I'm like, that is not the song. That is not it. Not at all. This is Dark Elfman. Very Dark Elfman.
And if you have not seen Summer School, shame on you.
Oh my God.
You need to make that a priority this weekend.
Chainsaw. For Chainsaw sure. Is the bomb,
Chainsaw
man.
Brothers. Yeah.
He's the bam. Ah! Tension Breaker. Had to be done. Just so good. My last one, it's a movie I love, and I listen to the soundtrack like a bazillion times. It's called Fright Night. It's a 80s vampire movie.
Yes.
Hope more people welcome to Fright Night. But J. Geils Band, which is one of my favorite 80s bands, they had a cover song for Fright Night, or the title song, I'm sorry. And then there's Autographs on there, Ian Hunter's on there, Devo's on there. I mean, there's Brad Fidel, who's normally a composer, really popular in the 80s. He actually took the theme from Fright Night and wrote a song to it. He's not a great singer, but I like the words. And if you've seen the movie, it really fits. So it's very cool. And Sparks, Armies of the Night is a great song. Like, I love the songs on this thing. Give It Up is a song where I love the scene that it's from. So when you hear it on the soundtrack, all it makes me do is think of that scene. And I love that movie. It's one of my favorite horror movies. So the soundtrack just makes me feel like I was 12 or 13 or whatever I was when I watched that movie. That's what it does every time I hear it.
And if you haven't seen it, you should totally see it because Tom Holland was a director.
Yes, he was. Different guy. Different guy.
Oh, it's a different Tom Holland.
Yeah, I don't think he was an embryo at that point. So
I almost had the TNG. They were hanging on. The next generation was like, Tom Holland directed this? I'm in.
That's so funny. all right. So, Troy, and when I say, like, do a speed round. Give me, you got any honorable mentions you want to mention before we move on to listener polls? Just fast?
No, because, I mean, most of the honorable mentions after you get out of these, like, big ones here, I mean, it's the 90s has got such really great stuff.
Yeah, we'll have to come back to the 90s.
It almost feels like we have to do another episode with 90s music.
Have to.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Have to. All right, Amanda, what about you? Anything you want to make sure to mention?
No, I think we covered all the bases.
Well, okay, I've got a few. So I'm just going
to
throw it.
I mean, Back to School could be one. I like the Back to School soundtrack.
Back to School's good. That's got Dead Man's Party on it.
Yep, Dead Man's Party. Oingo Boingo. Yep.
I'm just going to go through them. Just name them. I'm not even going to stop and give you too much anecdotes, all right? Sure. Michael Mann was a great curator of music. So Manhunter and Band of the Hand, both of those soundtracks, I love them, and they both scream 80s. Dragnet. Because City of Crime is one of my favorite stupid songs of all time. Do the Right Thing. That's a fantastic soundtrack. Real Genius didn't have a proper soundtrack, but it goddamn deserved one because all the songs on that freaking movie are fantastic.
They're great.
Oh, Less Than Zero.
So is the movie.
16 Candles. Black Rain. I love the movie,
yes.
Black Rain. Batman. I talked about The Goonies. Mm-hmm. I think Valley Girl deserves a shout out, which ironically had E.G. Daily in it in this small supporting role. And also played the mom in the Valley Girl remake. What? Crazy world. I'm learning all kinds of new stuff. Cocktail, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. We're talking about John Hughes. Twist and Shout, one of the most iconic music moments in film history. Beaches, Maximum Overdrive, AC/DC album. It's basically what it is. It's great. And Flash Gordon. Got to mention Flash Gordon. Such a weird
Do you, thing. Though? Do
yep.
you, though?
The universe.
Yep. Okay, so now let's do
for every one of us.
Let's do the listener top 10 from our poll that we put on Facebook, which we always put our topic on Facebook. And this saddens me that number 10 is Purple Rain. It saddens me, people. Saddens me. Seriously. Number 9, Beverly Hills Cop. Number 8, The Blues Brothers. Number 7, The Breakfast Club. Number 6, Ghostbusters. Number 5, Dirty Dancing. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's probably more beloved by other people than us, sounds like, right? All right. Nobody puts Baby in a Corner.
I mean, the movie's good. I don't know if I'd, like, run to go listen to the soundtrack. That's the problem with that movie. Like,
I feel like
soundtrack
it's
by
one
itself.
Song.
What, She's Like the Wind? Or A Time of My Life?
Time of My Life.
Sorry, too soon? Let's see. Number 4 is The Lost Boys. Number 3 is Back to the Future. Number 2, Footloose. Everybody cut loose. Footloose. Again, Kenny Loggins. freaking master of the soundtrack, the 80s soundtrack songs.
Honestly, I feel like because I didn't grow up with that movie, I grew up constantly hearing it and hearing the soundtrack, that I'm to the point where I can't freaking stand that soundtrack. I'm just so over it because I wasn't even a part of that era, but I've still been forced to endure it like I was. Like, I'm just over it.
Fair enough.
Kind of the rest of us that are just trying to let that other one go.
Yeah.
The number one soundtrack is Top Gun. I will say, I think there's a little recency bias in that, but it is.
There could be.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't mention was Flashdance. Flashdance has got a good soundtrack, too.
We didn't. Fame had a good soundtrack. Fame. There's a lot of stuff that had. Irene Cara, man. She was great. I loved her. All right. Remember, guys, the next time you head to a theater, buy popcorn.